Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network Weekly Lecture Series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Thank you, Marita. Thank you all for coming. And thank you to WGBH, who generously supported this series over all its years of development, and for this event, too. But mostly, thank you for coming. It's a weeknight, it's crummy weather, and we really appreciate it. The subtitle of this event is Engage the Experts, right? So what we'd like to do is get quickly to that. The experts are, of course, not only here, but they're in the audience. And we want to make sure we have plenty of time for give and take. In fact, we structured the evening like good producers in three acts. So the first act is a clip. The second act will be a panel discussion. We'll talk about some overarching issues. And then the third act is you. There'll be microphones, and we can do the mechanics of that. Thank you very much. We'll see you after the clip. We thank you. I thank you on behalf of all the people that are right now, still, as we speak, grinding away in the editing room. Greg Barker, who is the director of the second night's film, is, to my knowledge, he may be in this room, but I think he's in the editing room. Anyway, the film continues up to the present, and we cover what's called the next wave of AIDS. Of course, you know what that is. It says the virus moved into China and India and Russia, most populous, very important countries. And we also cover the tremendous political debates about how to spend the money that's now available in the global community. There's about $20 billion, right, on the table. And there's tremendous debates about how to spend that money, who should get it, and how to spend it. So it's a complicated film. But let me introduce the panel. First, William W. Dodge. You'll recognize him from the clip. He's been HIV positive. He's been HIV positive for 10 years, and since then, he deserves the applause. He's been involved with clinical trials ever since, so we thank him. Next in, Dr. Jim Young Kim is the chief of the Division of Social Medicine and Health Inequalities at Brigham and Women's. He came back to Boston recently from Geneva, where he was director of the World Health Organization's HIV/AIDS department. I think I'm just going to read the rest of his intro. When he was at WHO, he focused on initiatives that help developing countries scale up their treatment, prevention, and healthcare programs. He's a founding trustee and the former executive director of Partners in Health. And yesterday, here's why I had to read the rest of it. He was named by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential Americans, and we are thrilled to have him here tonight. Not to play favorites. Dr. Heidi Befferoz, next to him, is the founder and executive director of the Prevention and Access to Care and Treatment Project here in Boston. It's a unique program. It employs community health promoters, to advocate for the health and well-being of inner-city residents who are infected with or at risk of HIV. And Dr. Befferoz is also a physician at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, and has really focused her career on health issues of the urban indigent. Thank you for being here. Dr. Cal Cohen is the research director of the Community Research Initiative of New England, our sponsor. And we thank him very much. Very moving story that was told about sitting around thinking, how can we help our friends who are dying? We've all had stories like that. He has served as co-chair of the Scientific Advisory Committee of the AMFAR Community-Based Clinical Trial Network and was a co-investigator of the Harvard AIDS Clinical Trial Unit. Dr. Cohen is also a co-principal investigator of the New England AIDS Education Training Center and is a co-investigator and member of the Scientific Planning Council for the Community Program for Clinical Research on AIDS. Very complicated acronym that I won't read. And it's supported by the NIH and does very important work. Thank you so much. And last, Dr. David Ho, who you saw in the clip. Is the founding director and the scientific director and chief executive officer of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center for the Community of New York. Isn't that the full title?
For the
City of New York. I guess I shouldn't get so. He's been actively engaged in AIDS research for 24 years. And aside from the work that you saw in that clip, Dr. Ho has been pursuing new strategies with HIV vaccine development, and as well as a major public health initiative in China. So those introductions describe your professional lives, but I'd really like to start with a question about how you took those first steps on this long road. David, how did you first hear, when did you first encounter AIDS, HIV/AIDS?
To be precise, it was 25 years and 7 months ago. I was a senior medical resident in Los Angeles, and I happened to see a case with PCP, toxoplasma, and numerous other infection in a gay man.
And these are odd?
Well, at the time, these infections would be odd in a person who was not otherwise immunocompromised. And that case puzzled me a great deal, and then in the ensuing months we saw a few more, and two of those cases were included in the MMWR led by Michael Gottlieb.
So that was the report when the doctors, when Gottlieb and a few other colleagues got in touch with the CDC in June, in May perhaps, of 1981, and said, we see something really strange going on here.
It was clear that the physicians, the infectious disease physicians, were seeing these cases, a handful at UCLA and a handful at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center on the west part of Los Angeles. And there was a spike in the request for a drug called pentamidine, which was used to treat PCP.
Right.
And so CDC noticed that and sent what's called an EIS officer down to Los Angeles to investigate. And those cases were then grouped together, and Michael Gottlieb made the seminal contribution of measuring their T-cell counts using monoclonal antibodies that were just developed in the prior year or two to against molecule called CD4 and CD8.
And the T cell count tells you how vigorous the immune system is, just in case we're right?
Right. And he made the observation the common denominator was a low CD4 T cell count.
So that was when you first encountered it, right at the beginning. Dr. Cohen.
Well, just about the same story, really. I think I was a medical student, so a little bit younger. But only a little bit. And so during medical school training, I was in the Bronx.
Ah.
And it was 1981.
Ah.
And so the rest, in some ways, is predictable from there. And so, like with David, we were seeing our own versions of the story in the Bronx of people, in our case, showing up with these odd purplish blotches and winding up in hospital rooms, dying of something we didn't understand. And I was part of the medical community. I had gone to medical school thinking I was going to tackle the current great killer of mankind, which was heart disease. And what could be more important than heart disease? And then there were a couple of cases of these funny purplish blotches, and then it got a name. Of course, it was First Grid, as your film goes into. And we didn't know what to do. Of course, we were wearing gowns and using alcohol pads and our stethoscopes because we didn't know what we were up against. But it became clear from the beginning that a few of us we're going to stay and fight this one, while a lot of my colleagues decided they wanted to get as far from this odd thing as possible. But right from the beginning...
Why did you make that decision?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons. Certainly, at the time, it was pretty clear that this was happening to my community. It was happening to a community that was, in some ways, on its own at the very beginning of saying, what are we going to do about this one?
Right.
And so we, those of us who had some medical skills, brought what we could and talked to our mentors who were going to try to shed some light on this one and created a partnership. It was really a profound time because certainly in my medical training years, that partnership was at the beginning of so many unknowns, and the attitude amongst people who were interested, physicians interested in HIV, was different from any other field because we weren't competing with each other. We were a small group of people who were going to be drawn together to fight this one together. And there was a come on down feeling to it, like, we need all the help we can get. If you're interested, come on down.
Mm-hmm.
To finish the cardiology story, Eugene Braunwald, the great leader of cardiology in Boston, when a colleague a year ahead of me in medical school training went to Eugene at the completion of his training and said, so what do you want to be? I want to be a cardiologist like you. He said, great, just what the world needs is another cardiologist. That wasn't what we had in HIV. In HIV, it was exactly the opposite, which is we need everyone who's interested.
Right.
Come on, join the
fight.
And we
still do.
And we still
do. We'll get to that later. Dr. Breffers.
So I first encountered HIV in medical school class, where this was in the early 90s, when the virus was really presented to us as an incredibly powerful thing. And I think it has continued to be a real challenge for us in the sense that it's this thing that has figured out if you're going to attack the immune system, you don't go for the soldier, you go for the lieutenant. And it wipes it out and people get sick. And the immunology of it's very complex. The treatment of it was very complex. But I have to say that the first time I think I really encountered AIDS was in the home of a patient when I was a resident, and this was after the cocktail was available, and did a home visit in Roxbury, which is a community here in Boston, and saw an 84-pound, 27-year-old black woman dying from AIDS within walking distance of some of the premier institutions, medical institutions in the world. And being alarmed, here we are living in a society where we have the technology, and yet this isn't an issue necessarily of access, but of utilization. And realizing that HIV really is a very harsh mirror reflecting societal ills, and there's a role for champions in terms of physician advocacy and making sure that the technology we have available to us is diffused to everyone who needs it. And I think AIDS has really been a clarion call for those of us who want to explore that part of healing.
Fantastic. Dr. King. Yeah.
I was a medical student, a first-year medical student in 1982, and we'd all been hearing about HIV/AIDS. And then our class started something called Introduction to Clinical Medicine. And one of the students, in fact, he was a dental student, was assigned to examine a patient with AIDS at one of the local hospitals. And we all remember him describing what he had to put on. I mean, it was basically the outbreak sort of gear. And he was terrified. And I just remember thinking, if this young guy is terrified, what is this person going through who's sitting in this bed? People, treating him, or it was a him at the time, in such a way. And then soon after that, not too soon, I went off and did a PhD in anthropology where I studied the pharmaceutical industry, actually. Then I came back. That's the interest that I've always had in access to generic drugs. I studied the pharmaceutical industry in Korea that has a very active generic industry and gave me some ideas about how drugs might be made cheaply and made available to everybody. But then I really experienced it in a different way with the Haitian community. I began working with Paul Farmer in 1987. And we began to see the devastation of the racist images of Haitians as AIDS carriers. And I'll never forget that one of the kids, we'd made a film about HIV, and it was basically a film about anti-racism, you know, fighting against the racism that Haitians were going through. But it was also an AIDS education film for Haitian youth. Mm-hmm. And there was a student who'd written a wonderful essay for high school. And in it he wrote, AIDS can affect anyone. We should have compassion for people with AIDS. I know people who are living with AIDS, and they deserve not to be discriminated against. No one knows where it came from, but we're Haitians and we're going to stand against AIDS. And the teacher wrote, and we still have a copy of this, no, this is wrong. My doctor told me we do know where AIDS comes from. It comes from Haiti because Haitians have sex with monkeys.
Oh, dear.
Now, you know, there are no monkeys in Haiti, by the way.
The best of PBS. Yeah.
So that was the second phase. And then I really got involved when the access to drugs issue really came around. This was my thing. And of course, with the 3x5 initiative, we really tried to do whatever we could to expand access.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Dodge. Okay.
For me, there's no medical connection to how I learned about it. I was living in France, in Paris. I moved there in 1987. And HIV wasn't so much talked about openly as it was whispered about openly. You'd hear whispers about, you know, this friend Gary, he's positive, or this other friend, or this designer. And then suddenly my friends would start getting sick and start dying. Or when I returned back to the United States and in the 90s, it was, you know, I'll see you in a couple of years, and I won't be here in a couple of years. So it was just a personal connection of friends who died.
Right, but it was an abstraction then to you, not sort of a personal. But you were very careful about your own behavior, right?
Yeah, because in North Carolina, I mean, I grew up in North Carolina, but I think to give you an idea, I graduated from high school in 1984. And I'm from a generation that was not as promiscuous as kids are today at very early ages. So my kind of sexual behaviors were established right as the evening news was covering this report, and it was very scary. So I kind of made a decision to use condoms. It just seemed logical, and not to make an exception for it. Because if you start making an exception, then you start walking gray areas.
Right. Now, Heidi, I was thinking about the contrast between Dodge's experience that we saw in the clip and some of the experiences that you've observed and been part of with your clients. How do you make sense of that?
I think that, you know, we can read all the statistics. I mean, if you literally look at the epidemic, I mean, it certainly started in a community, primarily the gay men's community. But the epidemic has really started to shift, both globally as well as here, in that it is becoming more and more a disease of people who are poor and marginalized, either by the basis of their color or their class, you know, poverty of opportunity as well. And we're seeing it become more and more the face of women, more and more people who are being infected through heterosexual transmission. And if you look now, for instance, almost two-thirds of people who have AIDS, you have to consider that there's HIV, but then if you don't get appropriate care and you get AIDS, which is the more advanced disease, two-thirds of those people in this country are people of color, despite the fact that they only comprise 12% of the population. And if you look globally in the world, 95% of the people who are struggling with AIDS are people who are poor. And so we're seeing this shift, and I think the thing that is concerning are those disproportionately high mortality rates. We know what we need to do to treat people and what is standing in the way of treatment. And I hope we'll talk a little bit about that, because I think this is our challenge now, is how to diffuse this technology and how to make sure that everyone not only has access to, but can effectively utilize the resources that are available.
Mm-hmm. And David, you've been doing work in China where there is a machine in place, and in some ways starting with a country that has all the ingredients that it would need to make those kinds of drugs available to everyone. Tell us about what's happening there.
In China?
Yeah.
Well, China has a substantial epidemic. In fact, it has two sub-epidemics, one in central part of the country, and that epidemic was caused by unsanitary blood selling, blood collection practice. And we don't really know how many people are infected, but there's one province called Henan, which, by the way, has about 100 million people. And about 80-90% of them are poor farmers. And we know that the epidemic in certain villages in Henan is as severe as what we see in certain African situations. The Chinese estimate would be a few hundred thousand cases, but there's a huge AIDS orphan problem there, so we know it's quite devastating. In southwest China, near the Burmese and Vietnamese border, there is a separate epidemic propelled by injection drug use. Heroin is very cheap there. It's very proximal to the Golden Triangle, and that epidemic is still spreading at a very much alarming rate, and the prevalence among injection drug users is as high as 70% in certain counties. So that's sort of the epidemic in China. There is now increasing transmission via sexual contact, both heterosexual and homosexual. But that's more likely in the urban setting and in the eastern seaboard, the more prosperous parts of China.
And it's an interesting thing to think about China in relationship to there being these kind of two epidemics, the one with the sort of poor, maybe intravenous drug and heterosexual spread, and the sort of more affluent. Dr. Cohen, you were telling me about that other epidemic. Because in China, there are the two epidemics. There's also the machinery to make the drugs and the political authoritarianism to get them out there if it happens. But just on the general theme of relating the global picture to the local picture, tell us about what you're seeing.
So certainly, as we've talked about, the way that HIV hit, at least in the Western countries, in the States and Western Europe, was largely through the sexual transmission amongst people who didn't always have money, but certainly by and large were either middle class, upper class, people who could travel, people who could be on jets and one day be in New York, the next in LA. It was a time in which affluence brought travel, it brought fun, it brought the ability to kind of enjoy life. And it was certainly a wonderful decade, the 70s, in the sense that sex actually used to be a good thing. There was a time in which that was, in fact, possible to consider that way. Touche.
He says touche.
But at least there was a... It is. But it didn't seem to have so many consequences. At least the next morning.
That's the issue.
Beyond the next
that's
morning.
That's the issue in Africa.
Exactly. So that and so there was this this wonderful time in which people with cash would certainly be able to kind of enjoy life, and so the parties and the Fire Island and the sunsets and the Rock Hudson stories, and all of that was part of, in some ways, the crystal around which the first vision of HIV hit, because it was a vision of people who were having wonderful, tragic endings to all of that society could do, in which all of the resources could bring to bear. And that is certainly still with us today. We certainly, as some of us were talking about in the reception earlier, realizing that we're still at a time in which, in part because of the success of treatment, we're now seeing another wave of people who are once again experiencing that sex and the ability to enjoy each other's company is a good thing, and forgetting that this miserable decade taught us so many lessons, and we're now seeing this kind of this return to what was always there, which is the ability to enjoy each other's companies, and a fear that part of the success that we are now enjoying may be allowing us to see yet another wave of HIV happen, on top of which, of course, are yet another wave of party drugs and the kind of the loss of inhibition around sex. And so there is this kind of ongoing vigilance in this epidemic. There really was a sense in obviously in hour two that AIDS is almost over. It's just a couple of drugs and cocktails away from being done. And so many times in this epidemic, we're reminded in each of our communities how that sense of almost done had that Spielbergian, you know, it's a 10-year-old kid who's going to say, aha, it's this, and the whole thing is over, and we're all going to go back to our wonderful lives. And this epidemic is this constant reminder of how far we keep getting from that, even though we also keep getting so much closer to being able to contain it. The ability to contain it just gets further and further out of our reach. And all the people here who've done each of their parts to try to get us ahead of the curve while we just watch ourselves losing progress at the same time.
Right. Dr. Kim, what can you do that for us? Take us from the local to the global and perhaps back again. It's your arc. You've done this.
Well, just to pick up on a couple of points, China, what's really interesting is when they decided to take action, boy, did they take
That's
action.
Right,
so, for example, they just announced a little while ago, maybe a year ago, that they're going to offer methadone maintenance therapy and sterile needle exchange for everyone. So I went there as WHO's representative. I said, how did you do this? How did you convince the people? Don't people make arguments to you like it's immoral? And they said, well, we just looked at the evidence. These are the two of the most effective prevention tools we've ever had. And we told everyone that if we don't do this, people are going to die. I said, exactly. and it gets me back. I mean, when I made that comment, sex is a good thing, and lots of Africans are having lots of sex. And I don't know that moralizing and blaming and accusing has ever done us any good in this epidemic. So, in fact, for example, in Russia, when I was at WHO, I met with ministers of health, and I confronted the Russian minister of health, and I said, you guys have to offer methadone, and you have to offer clean needles. And he says, well, it is not part of Russian culture. He said. And I went back by saying, but the Russians are very scientifically oriented and the data is there. And he says, well, we just can't do it. And so if Russia doesn't do it, it's hard to get the Ukraine to do it. It's hard to get Belarus to do it. It's hard to get Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan to do it. And people are just dying because of these. They're saying these are degenerates. Why should we give free needles to these degenerates? This doesn't work. Telling people to abstain from sex, telling people to be faithful to their husbands when, in fact, marriage is the biggest risk factor for becoming infected with HIV. We have to just know. We have to know when moralization or pointing fingers doesn't work, and it doesn't work so often. So sex is a good thing. People having lots of sex. How do we figure out ways of making condom use more effective? How do we figure out how to stop the spread of the disease, and now how do we figure out how to deliver this beautiful triple combination cocktail that Dr. Ho discovered? How do we make this available to everyone? It doesn't, in either here in the United States or anywhere else, the thing that I've learned is that sitting back and making moral judgments is just not helpful.
Right.
Get the real data and information about how this thing is spread, and let's stop it.
I think that's right. And Heidi and I were talking beforehand that sometimes those blocks occur at the very community level. You were telling me about some of your own efforts to make big prevention changes.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've learned through this epidemic is that you can't separate prevention and treatment. And it's interesting to hear the fluid exchange between the two realms, because is one disease where you really have to tackle both at the same time. And, one of the struggles that we have here in the Northeast particularly is that injection drug use, it's a major reservoir of new HIV infection, particularly among women. About 60% of women in Massachusetts actually got their HIV infection through contact, through injection drug use. So it's a huge issue, and you know, one of the things that we haven't done, like China, you know, there's still a federal ban on needle exchange in this country. And there are many states where needle exchange programs, even in terms of city and state, are underground or illegal. Fortunately, here in Massachusetts, you know, there are needle exchange programs, could be more robust, but we're dealing with the issue of funding and also that sense of political commitment as well. And so there are challenges that we face. Right now we have an injection drug user group that goes out into the street and does needle exchange in the community with Latinos, huge need. And you know, we're blocked because of these issues around politics and finances. And it's very frustrating when you see that the epidemic is spreading among populations. We know what we need to do and can't.
Absolutely, yeah.
Just one little thing on treatment and prevention. You know, we had these really stupid debates for a long time. And I don't mean to denigrate anyone who was involved in them, but we were talking about, you know, in developing countries, is it treatment or prevention, treatment versus prevention? And, you know, I have to say that I've watched very carefully Gay Men's Health Crisis ACT UP, these groups, people like Mr. Dodge, who put their bodies on the line to get these drugs tested and approved. Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't long after we started getting some sense that these drugs were going to be effective. The people like Eric Sawyer and Greg Gonsalves and Mark Harrington started screaming that if they're going to get the drugs, everyone should get the drugs. I think that what the gay community in the United States concerned with HIV/AIDS did in terms of reaching out, their solidarity with people in Africa, is one of the great cultural stories of our time. I think it's one of those moments. I'm an anthropologist and we study this. You know, I hope to write about this because, you know, when I was at WHO, it was Greg and Mark Herring. Those were the go-to guys. Zaki Ahmed, you know, they were always the ones that we called, and they were always the ones who would just put anything on the line to take the next step, you know, whatever we needed to do. You know, personally, it's a source of great pride that an Asian American developed this triple cocktail, because I don't think our community is anywhere close in terms of showing the kind of solidarity that was shown and is still being shown. I mean, Greg Gonsalves just sent a note out. He's going to South Africa after all these years of working at Gay Men's Health Crisis. And, you know, the thing that's also a great lesson is that when you are a community that's fighting for your life and you've got nothing more to lose, you can scare the shit, excuse my language, PBS, sorry, out of powerful people. Because powerful people are extremely thin-skinned.
Yeah.
You know. So the fact that the activists were ready to do anything to get their cause out there, and not just drugs for themselves. Mm-hmm. If that was all it was, and they had stopped there, then I think we would have seen it as a very self-interested and predictable kind of movement. But they went so far beyond that. Now, I just want to make one point about that. And we've been criticized, those of us who are, quote, treatment activists, because we're taking attention away from prevention. Well, let me tell you, in developing countries, there was no attention to prevention, right? It's a complete myth that there was all this prevention going on, and all of a sudden treatment came in and took it all away. That's not what happened. It was only after we began talking about treatment in developing countries that we got the money we needed to do what we had to do.
Right.
And for the first few years, both the Global Fund and PEPFAR spent more money on prevention than on treatment. Yeah. And we still spend billions now. And, you know, just to give you an example, during the 1990s, Lincoln Chen and Helen Epstein wrote in an article in the New York Review of Books that the average amount of money spent by the U.S. government on prevention in developing countries was about $70 million a year, mm-hmm. which was exactly the same amount that had been allotted for Viagra for the U.S. military.
Right.
So we were not, and now we have billions, but the reason we have billions is because the triple combination therapy, saving lives, preventing orphans, that somehow clicked in people's minds. And that's always been the story. If you can treat, if you can save lives, people can get behind it and understand it and give money for it. It was behind the treatment activism that we were able to finally get enough money to do prevention.
Yeah. Well, yes, you talking about, go ahead.
I just want to follow up on what Jim just said. I think I wear two hats, one in the U.S. as a basic scientist working on this problem. In China, I wear a public health hat. And in the U.S., we work on HIV vaccine development, which is arguably the most important thing scientifically to address this epidemic on the prevention side. But what Jim just said and what's been said earlier, I completely agree with. You know, we went to China some 6 years ago with a research agenda to develop vaccine and test vaccine there. And concurrently, we had to address certain prevention issues. But all those efforts were rather meaningless when the immediate issues of training people, building infrastructure, and getting patients treated were much more pressing. And therefore, over the last 5-6 years, with the public health hat on, we started to do things that are more on the treatment side. And now the consequences on the prevention side are real. Just as an example, we have in two different provinces in China a number of mother-to-child transmission programs. Fairly straightforward. We know rather efficacious based on data generated in the West. But as we do that now, the spin-off is now in one province, every pregnant woman is tested, everyone applying for a marriage license is tested, and associated with testing, there's some level of VCT, not the entire VCT that we're familiar with here in the U.S. But it's a perfect example of how treatment and prevention are linked.
It is, and VCT being voluntary testing and counseling always going together. That's another issue that's global and local, right? Because we have in Massachusetts the move to report names. And I know Dodge has some very strong feelings about what should happen once...
Reporting names?
Yes.
I think you're not going to get people tested. I mean, we're living... I'm not a conspiracy theorist on any level, but... We're living in a country where our data is collected all the time. Our data is collected when we use that card at the grocery store. Walmart is acquiring so much data, it's obscene. And then after the thing with the NSC. You know, we can say we're going to report... I mean, I really don't know what they're going to do with the data, but you report the name, you connect the names with the positive, negative, or just having been tested situation, and what can that be used for, and what would like the current administration use it for?
So, as a person who put yourself in someone's shoes, going for a test now, you just wouldn't.
I wouldn't do it. I'd go to another state, you know, or find some other way to do it.
And your doctor or public health, no one could say anything that would make you feel secure enough to take that test.
No, because I don't trust them.
Okay.
I don't trust them. You know, it's this country over and over has used information against people. I mean, the McCarthy hearings, it's just something that pops its head up often, and HIV is still very much a loaded thing in this country.
And how important, Dr. Kim, how important is testing to know what the epidemic is doing, where it is?
You know, there is no simple answer on testing and counseling.
Right.
I think it looks different in different places. I mean, right now I'm working on a project in the country of Lesotho, where, and let me be very specific about the language, the project is to try to offer voluntary counseling, confidential voluntary counseling and testing to everyone in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they have anywhere from 25 to 30% of the adults infected.
Offer, so not mandatory.
It's the offer. But before we do that, the way that we've drawn up the plan is that protection of human rights is at the core of that plan. And no community will go forward with this more routine, shall we say, or perhaps more proactive program of offering voluntary counseling and testing unless we get certain human rights issues really clarified. This is terribly difficult because there's no real clear answer. If one of every three adults is infected with HIV/AIDS and the death rate is just skyrocketing, the most important human right seems to me to be able to live. And
right.
I think Is there a way of building a hierarchy of human rights? I don't know the answer to that. I'm not a philosopher. But I know that the kind of death rates we're seeing in some of these countries require us to do something else. Now, to me, the beauty of setting yourself a real target for voluntary counseling and testing is that it forces you to put both prevention and treatment services in place.
Right.
Voluntary counseling and testing can be that critical link. And what I think it's going to do in Lesotho is just give pace and rhythm to the process of scaling up both HIV prevention and treatment. Mm-hmm. You've got to have both in place if you're going to give, offer a voluntary test to everyone. It's been misunderstood, and I have been personally excoriated on the listservs for supporting this initiative. But, I'm there. I'm watching all these deaths. The only growth industry is the funeral homes. And the people there are telling me, if we don't do something quickly, we're going to be extinct in 20 years.
I think so, that's true.
I think the human rights issue is critical. We've got to protect human rights. We've got to think about it in every step of the process. But we've also got to be creative, and we've got to think about countries like Swaziland and Zambia and Lesotho and South Africa that face true collapse if we don't do something much more active than we're mm-hmm. doing right now.
Mm-hmm. If I could add, I think one of the things that has been most powerful, and certainly Partners in Health has experienced this, and Jim alluded to this, is that you don't start doing counseling and testing until you have treatment available. There's no reason for someone to go and get tested and know they're positive if they're not going to have access to treatment. And I think, we certainly learned that you can go into a place where there is no treatment available. People don't come and get tested, but you tell them, we can treat you, we can help make you healthy, we can help you prevent your baby from getting infected. They'll come and get tested. And I think the other thing, one of the interesting things about Lesotho is that you have to look at the track of infection. These individuals are getting infected because they're the lowliest of the low mine workers in South Africa and don't have a means of a regular income or being infected there, bringing it home. So when you talk about human rights, you're also talking about making available economic opportunity, dealing with issues of gender inequality, all of those issues that allow someone to get to the point where taking care of themselves, taking care of others becomes a possibility.
Right.
And I think taking a comprehensive approach to treatment, David was talking about building infrastructure, HIV in some weird way is forcing us to do that and to build all of that.
Great. We do want to have some questions from the audience. So let's see. We can bring the lights up a little bit. We just touched on some of the issues. It's a very dense subject, and we hope we can get in, burrow in a little bit. The frontline staffers have mics in the aisles, and here's the procedure. You raise your hand if you have a question. They'll pass you the mic, and then you keep it in the air, and I'll... Yeah, there's a yellow microphone going in there. And if you want to identify yourself, fine, and if not, that's fine, too.
I'd be glad to do that. My name's Diego Sanchez. I want to thank you for what you've done tonight. This is an incredible night, an incredible... anticipating it was fabulous. The age of AIDS is 25. The year is 2006. And as a man of color, an immigrant, an orphan, we've touched on a lot of things that I am, I'll say that I feel a little bit like the person who came to dessert and then I was... maybe wanting a little dinner. And what I mean by that is I just need to say with the most proper and due respect, as I am a respectful man, there are no dark people on your stage. There's got to be room for a seat for a man or a woman of color. Our state, our country, is affected extremely by Latinos and African Americans and blacks. And although six is a... And all of you are fantastic. And I've learned a lot, and I appreciate it, and I love Cal, and he knows that. But I need to say that it is... I would be remiss if I could be here and not offer that. If you do this in other cities, I hope that you will include the communities that are most affected, who are most marginalized, as you wonderfully pointed out, and I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for that. Anyone else? Orange microphone over here.
Is that me?
Okay. Yes.
Hi, I'm Donna Gallagher. My question, or I guess my comment first, is in keeping with what Diego just said, it seems that the whole tone around the epidemic is shifting as it's shifting into the minority communities. And while we had the years where, as Cal described, you know, there was solidarity and the people who were providing care, we ate together, drank together, cried together, and it seemed like that community was very strong and able to provide what the patients needed. As the epidemic has moved into the minority communities, we don't have the providers of color. We are losing a lot of the providers who have been with the epidemic a long time.
Okay. There's no question.
And I guess my concern is really about the tone and how we can try and reverse this movement toward more punishment, more moral judgments. We have moved to wanting names all of a sudden because the majority of the patients are people of color. There's a tone of the Ryan White Care Act dollars are now called entitlement dollars.
Would you like to direct that to somebody on the panel?
I'll direct it to anybody. Cal usually is my director person. I direct all my questions to Cal.
Do you think that's true, that there's an attitude shift and it's because of the people who...
Well, I think that there's a lot of fear certainly in the medical training community, that there are not as many clinicians coming into medical school with the same passion to say, HIV is my career path, I'm going to join the fight. Uh-huh. We are seeing fewer people interested in this, certainly in this country. But there is a fear that that sense of community around HIV to fight it together is getting fractured. And I think that there are many reasons for it. Certainly, one of the stresses in the community right now is, as you point out with names reporting, how can a community trust reporting names to a government if the next speech from the government is, by the way, if the two of you men are going to sit on a couch and watch TV together, that threatens my marriage? How can we trust you with my name if something as simple as that is considered a threat? Why would I trust you? And so, of course, we're living through an era unlike the era that Clinton tried to represent, in which he symbolized the ability to bring people together around a community of caring for each other. I mean, when he came to Boston a couple of years ago, he impassioned our audience, our medical audience, at a conference and said, you know, if all of you in the medical world get this right and figure out how to treat this virus right, and if all of us in the political world get this right and get the treatment to the world, then one of these days, maybe HIV will flow from our blood into our history books where it belongs.
Mm-hmm.
What a message he gave us to work together to get this behind us.
Well,
we're in such a different era in which, in some ways, the symbol for this era is, you know, you're going to go on a list and we're going to make sure you pay the price for your errors of your ways. And it's such a different tone that we're living through now.
It's interesting. We have another question with the yellow mic right here.
Yeah, my name is Nathan Bolstridge. My question is an open question to anyone, and it's basically what I've seen and heard is that the epidemic has and has always been about power disparities and between the haves and the have-nots, and within the past 25 years that's just gotten stronger. And I'm wondering what measures we can think of to address that in the next, hopefully less than 25 years, to end the epidemic, or just to think about why it's moving from the position where it is to even more of between people who have money, who have power, who have influence, to people who have none of those things.
Can I take a shot at that?
Sure, please, Dr. Kim. You know,
So if you just look at the amount of money that has been spent on various public health efforts, all of smallpox eradication cost $330 million. All of polio eradication from 1988, still ongoing, it's been about $4 or $5 billion. And we've got $10 billion this year to fight HIV/AIDS in developing countries. You know, hats off to everybody in this room who I'm sure has really fought to try to get more attention to this problem. And for some reason, Bush, Chirac, Blair, all the great leaders have made this huge commitment to tackling HIV/AIDS. I mean, I think there's a reason for it. if the Southern African economy collapses, it's going to have consequences for everybody. But somehow it's just caught people's attention. And so, you know, the fact that we've got a triple drug combination that you can give people for the rest of their lives and that requires some kind of a functioning public health system has allowed us to use this money to finally build those public health systems that we should have had there for a long, long time. So I truly feel that this movement toward treating more people and preventing more infections is helping us offset the balance. We're finally moving in a direction that we should have been moving for a long time. But, you know, you hear all the time, well, you know, we're spending $3 billion this year, which is great. You know, the PEPFAR program is spending $3 billion. That's great. But, you know, we have to make a choice. It's either PEPFAR or Medicare. Why is that the choice? Why are those two things the choice? So since the beginning of the Iraq-Afghanistan struggle or wars, we've spent $400 billion on that, on those wars. And this year, the defense budget, without including Iraq and Afghanistan, is over $400 billion, right? So I think that's the comparison we need to make. And what we're doing behind the spending of money on HIV/AIDS is giving women jobs. We've now, I think, convinced the world that community health workers, poor men and poor women, need to be paid. People living with HIV/AIDS who are on medicines and are doing well now should be paid as health workers, bringing them into the health system and building the infrastructure that, frankly, we've promised Africa from pre-colonial times, during colonial times, during the period of structural adjustment. We promised we'd build it all those times, and we never did. So if it's AIDS that finally lets us build this, this is great. That's the optimistic side. But let me tell you, in another 3 or 4 years, we face a real threat. They're going to say, well, you know, it was kind of difficult, and, you know, it's $10 billion is just too much money. And so all of you have to be ready.
Right.
And my own sense is that because the medicines that are so good now, that we're not going to lose our greatest warriors and people, you know, like Zaki Achmet and Mark and Greg Gonzalez. These guys are not going to quit. And when people start backing off, you all have to be ready to say no. It's not just about the virus and about AIDS, but it's about social justice and people having a decent quality of life. Finally, if AIDS is the ticket in, why not?
Absolutely. Oh, the black man. Yes, that's good that you're standing.
My name's David. You didn't talk about a certain aspect of the HIV virus and AIDS. I'm a hemophiliac, and between 78 and 85, they didn't have a test the antibodies of HIV and AIDS.
That's right.
And I got tainted blood.
Sure.
And I may be a little bit nervous right now, but 9,500 hemophiliacs got infected in the U.S.
That's right.
And 7,000 have already died already. And I want to thank God and my country for providing these HIV drugs. I'm on a cocktail right now. And I don't have AIDS. I'm still asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to let you know that there are different people and aspects of people that can get, beginning with Ryan White and the Ricky
right.
Ray brothers, and
that's right.
That it affects the hemophilic community too.
Deeply. And their partners and children. When you look at it, the numbers, I think it goes up to about 30,000 people who are recipients of tainted blood products in this country, or their sex partners, or their children, or both. In the first night of the series, we cover that extensively, and we cover the meeting at which, you know, the activists, including Don Francis from the CDC, of course, who, you know, literally was pounding the table saying we have got to do something about this, and we cover the forces at play there, because blood banking, of course, is a for-profit industry. So it was an interesting segment to...
In the pharmaceutical companies, it failed to acknowledge that they infected us, and they deny it to this day, for they don't want to be liable to all the suits that they can get. And I have all the compassion in the world for people on the different way they have AIDS and how they got it. And I just hope everybody can live longer and healthier lives through the drugs that you guys provide. Thank
we
you.
We do, too. Thank you so much for that comment. So, Orange Mike, if you'd stand, please.
My name's Orange Miller, and I'd like to know if you guys could address what Dr. Cohen talked about earlier, the possible resurgence of this due to a false sense of security. We have pretty good drugs.
Let me ask Dodge to talk about some of his experiences recently.
To be quite honest, I'm getting quite frustrated, especially with the youth today. When I was coming along, you know, you saw this purple-spotted man and you saw the 85-pound man, and it was quite a scary thing. And now, you don't see that anymore. And now we're in the situation where to use condoms sometimes when it's appropriate. How do you know it's appropriate? And I'm, well, they'll tell me. And I'm like, why? Why would they? The reality for someone who's HIV positive is very different from the reality of someone who's HIV negative. I'm not as afraid of the virus. I've got something to lose, but I'm not afraid of it. And that is my reality. So I don't, my heart doesn't bleed a lot for, oh, you're going to be honest with me, you know, because you might infect me. I mean, yes, I use condoms because I believe in them. But I'm kind of appalled that the onus is put on the person who's positive to protect the whole world. Because a lot of the people who are positive don't know they're positive. And so, you know, if there's, you can look anywhere. You can look on the internet. And my favorite ad is always, drug and disease-free UB2. Yeah, how'd you know you're disease-free? And because no one really knows that they're free. They know if they've got it. They don't know if they're really free of it or not. And I think that's unfortunate.
Oh, Orange, please stand.
My name is Loretta McLaughlin.
I know. It's good to see you.
Writing about AIDS for a lot of years, and I certainly admire and respect each and every one of you. I think you're just wonderful. But I do detect a slightly self-congratulatory tone at the 25th anniversary of AIDS, when I think we all still should be standing up, screaming and shouting.
Right.
I would like to know what percentage of cases in which you administer your now wonderful drugs, do they fail to work? Right. Does the patient become resistant? And are they going to live pretty sick lives? And second, of all the people in the world who are currently infected, what percentage now, 25 years into this epidemic, are getting those drugs?
Right. If I could, I'd ask David Hoad, because we covered this at the back end of the series about the rate at which people become resistant, that their virus mutates. Is 50% in 5 years on a particular cocktail? Is that?
I think it completely depends on your patient population. I think if you have a previously drug-naive population coming in for the first time, you could get great results in the first 3 to 5 years with a majority. And that could range from slightly over 50% all the way to 80, 90%, depending on your population and, right. and the drugs you use. So there's clearly a failure rate. But I don't think we're here to talk about all the specifics of drug treatment. And I think if we conveyed a self-congratulatory tone, that would be totally inappropriate. I think, yes, we have made significant advances on the treatment side, and yet we have much more to do.
So what percentage do develop
resistance? I think for our... 100%
eventually. Well, Jim just said 100% eventually. I think that's something that people
don't have the data for that at this time. I think, but I think we really need to point out that there are so many challenges that lie ahead. If you look at the epidemic growth curve for Africa since 1996, when the so-called cocktail became available, it grew exponentially, as if the therapeutic advances had nothing, had no impact on sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. And we've been struggling to come up with a vaccine since 1983-84 when the virus was identified and isolated. We have not even come close to achieving that. So there are many, many such struggles that lay ahead, and right. I know that in the piece, it will be reasonably well covered.
Can you answer my question around? I know that I'm... But let's look. We've had 25 years, and we are where we are, and I think most of the people here really know where we are. But what do you see 25 years from now?
Ms. McLaughlin asked, what will we see 25 years from today?
And that, I actually was asked more or less a similar question during the
film,
interview
yeah.
for this frontline piece. I see that we will have better therapeutics. I hope we will have at least a partially protective vaccine 25 years from now. But I also see that, you know, we have had vaccines that protect against polio and many other important pathogens for many decades, and yet these diseases are still with us. And I certainly would say that I actually was by accident there at the beginning of the visible part of the epidemic, but I won't see the end of this epidemic, and I doubt if my children will see the end of this epidemic, because there's so many obstacles still in the way, and it takes so long, so much work and resources to implement, even if we had a cure or a protective vaccine today.
One of the take-home messages we really want people to take from the series is the fact that the treatments, it's not insulin, that as a diabetic or an HIV-positive person, you have a thing that will ameliorate your condition for the rest of your life. It's very difficult. This is a very clever virus that mutates, and so it requires constantly changing regimes and constantly updating. I have time for one more question. I'm sorry, the yellow mic. Hi, can you stand?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm Jack O'Leary, and I'd like to have you speak to stigma and how that differentiates this disease from every other disease. You know, when I moved here in 87 and I was an AIDS body volunteer, I remember the first thing that hit me was these people aren't dealing with AIDS, they're dealing with everything but AIDS.
Right.
And it still seems to be that, and the question about testing names, requirements, and things like that, and, you know, in the African countries, and just want to see how you address that as an impact.
Stigma.
Well, I'll dive in only because I actually do want to address Loretta's comment as a way to get to yours. Our best regimens are working so far with the 5 years of experience we have, and in some, 7 years experience, in which 3% of people have developed resistance to some of our best combinations when all goes well. The drugs are actually progressing to the point that we are doing good work, and that only 3% in one study, and in another study, only 5% have developed resistance. So we are, when all goes well, able to do a dramatically better job than even we had imagined 5 to 10 years ago. These regimens have evolved. All has to go well. We have to pick it well. Somebody has to take it well and feel well enough to take it. But there also has to be a community that supports it, because part of what I think unravels around HIV is, as you point out, is the stigma. So why is this different from a diabetic who says, you know, but insulin is hard, and how often does insulin fail? The difference is that nobody's ashamed to say, I'm the diabetic. And people are ashamed to say, you know, certainly there were lots of pieces of history to this, but it's, so in our world, HIV is just the virus. But what this did is that it was a lens on people who, unfortunately, were in a society in which they were stigmatized, and that's where HIV exploded, was in stigmatized communities. And so in sexual minority communities, in injection drug use communities, in the communities in our culture and the poor who were disenfranchised. And so HIV hit and spread in the communities in which people were already stigmatized in those communities. And so it's that HIV just
right.
traveled right along those lines and exploded in the communities in which it just created this shameful peace, rather than a disease that humans were going to band together to
right.
fight.
Right. We have we've run out of time, unfortunately. It's sort of tragic.
One last question. Yes.
Jim? Yes, please.
My name is Danny Harris. I'm with CRI on the CAB board. And I have two questions. One, what note does this film end on? And two, does this film deal with the onset of meth?
Crystal meth.
Crystal meth, because I believe that that's going to take this into another level that
yes,
you all would not.
Yes, well, actually, Frontline did a film about crystal meth a few weeks ago. Oh, that's terrific. Executive producer David Fanning right there. It's a terrific film. And Peter Staley was in that film and made those points. And we did not cover it in this episode the age of AIDS coming up to the present. Oh, my life flashed before my eyes. Anyway, so we didn't cover that in this. And how the series, thank you, David, how the series ends is partly on the note that Ms. McLaughlin was asking about. What's the reality of the future of this epidemic? And we have some of the voices. We have, Dodge saying the young generation has forgotten what a purple spotted 85-pound man looks like. We have David Ho saying what he said here, and various other scientists and Dr. Kim. I think it's a call to arms. It's to say that this is a preventable pandemic. It always was. And all we have to do is, get out there and do the education. Fight the stigma. Denial is bad. Good leadership is good. And prevention works. So that's pretty much where we... Please.
I think that if there was a sense of self-congratulation, it's really not what we should say. I mean, we started this initiative to get 3 million people on treatment, and we failed miserably. And I talked all the time about our failures, and people will get mad at me for that. But let me just say that the continued existence of stigma here in the United States, I think what it points out to is that because AIDS went down the fault lines of our societies, and it continues to go down the fault lines, the poor, the marginalized, what it gives us is the most fantastic challenge and opportunity for two things, for basic human solidarity, right? That the way that people living with HIV/AIDS have been able to show such enormous solidarity with others, and this opportunity we have now to use this money for social justice, this is the opportunity that it gives us that makes me optimistic. In 25 years, I'd like to see functioning health systems everywhere. I'd like to see an intellectual property regime that makes sense, that leads to real innovation, while at the same time giving everyone access. And it's AIDS that helped us really tackle those questions. And I'm not saying AIDS is a good thing, it's a horrible thing. But if we don't grab this opportunity with AIDS to work on building human solidarity and work on social justice, we're really going to have lost it.
At one of the closing comments, one of the closing comments in the series is from Zaki Akhmat, the South African activist that Jim was mentioning before. And he says, we cannot win the war against AIDS. HIV infection, 70 million people worldwide. We cannot win. But in fighting it, we can mitigate the disaster and we can show our humanity. That's another one of the big take home. And I'm sorry I have to wrap up. I have to thank our panelists very much for coming, for giving your time and energy.